Caroline, Willie, D-Mace, 102.5, 106.3, The Game and The Game Nashville app. We're live from the Hiller Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical Game Studios, and we are streaming live on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook Live every single day. Our video streaming is brought to you by Superbook. Download their app today and use promo code THEGAME. Joining us now is Jonathan Hutton, Hot Mike with Hutton Withrow, or as we like to call it, Hutton O'Clock, our favorite time of the week. Hutton, appreciate you for joining us. So we heard from Derrick Henry at the podium yesterday. And yesterday wasn't the best day for the offense. Two interceptions from Ryan Tannehill. It looked like the defense is really kind of settling into a groove. The offense has yet to do so. He was asked about offense versus defense, how you feeling about where the offense stands right now. And Derrick Henry said, yeah, you know, all you can really hope for is to get better every single day. It wasn't the best endorsement for where the offense is right now. What are your thoughts on where the offense has been right now and kind of Derrick Henry's evaluation of it so far?
Well, I'll give the opinion of the devil's advocate here. First, I hear things like that. And look, I've not been able to attend every practice because of a schedule. Mm-hmm. I think first, no DeAndre Hopkins yesterday.
Yep.
I think that was evident in the passing game. And second, when I hear, you know, oh, things are progressing, you know, it's defense is ahead. Defense is, at least typically here, Mace, Caroline, mm-hmm. from what we've all observed, defenses tend to be ahead this time of year anyway of the offense. I'm eager about the preseason, eager about the joint practices, but here's where I'm concerned. This offense sucked last year.
Yeah.
And this offense was slow out of the gate last year. So I need to see more than just, well, you know, we're coming along and, you know, some days are good, some days are bad, but everything evens out. And I'm paraphrasing that into all one answer from what I've heard. And I think a lot of it is just, you know, coloring outside the lines a little bit with what is actually going on. The offensive line has to be a cohesive group. That's why they're keeping Skoronski where he is at left guard. That's why Brunskill's staying at right guard. They need that center guard triangle to be really solid. It's going to be tough without Ben Jones. Beyond that, they need their top guys available, and that's evident. There's not much depth at certain spots across this offense. And if Tannehill doesn't have time, if the receivers that are backing up DeAndre Hopkins don't have the same rapport with Tannehill, like Hopkins, the veteran savvy, brings to the field, That's what you get. And the one thing we haven't seen is with full pads, Henry behind this offensive line, mm-hmm. Like we will see in week one. I don't know if we'll see much of it in the team sessions of the joint practices either, because we didn't last year. But that's the other aspect of the offense that we have yet to really see nailed out. And that's giving them the benefit of the doubt, as well as the additions in the backfield with Spears.
And that's why I'm so glad that we're so close to a preseason game, that we can actually see this offense going up against another defense, actually, you know, running in-game plays. But Titans taking on the Bears in the first preseason game of the season on Saturday, what are you going to look at most intently? What are you most excited to see on Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited, but at the same time, like, we're going to see this offense. We're going to see the backup offense and the third-string offense with a rookie quarterback and a second-year quarterback that is said to be vastly improved. And that's different than the veteran quarterback in Tannehill running things. Mm-hmm. So we won't see them at full strength. Right. Here is and defensively, I'm excited to see the depth at corner Mace has hit on this a couple of weeks back. But I don't expect to see some of the vets out there. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, I mean, depth at corner is an issue, and it has been the last couple of years. Inside linebacker, what's going on with Monty Rice? Jack Gibbons battling for that spot. And, you know, the other aspects on offense are to me, with the starters, the Titans, going back to this, they look bad on offense in their opening games the last several seasons. Last year, the defense gave up over 200 rushing yards. I don't say the preseason games need to be full throttle, but the O-line, I need to see the O-line get six full quarters minimum this preseason. I know the risk factor of the injury, but they cannot risk looking awful in week one, and because they didn't have things prepared when they had the option of really going up against some backups in the preseason. I need to see full pads, full throttle, you know, all out and then judge what we're seeing versus what – and Vrabel paces the practice as well, but he adds reps without adding miles on the tires, so to speak. I'm really concerned about the group, especially at right tackle. But beyond that, I mean, four new starters means a lot. And this is more than just getting by until Nicholas Petitfrere gets back in 6 weeks.
Now, Jonathan, you brought up something with the offensive line, and I heard that, you know, in Jacksonville, Peterson said, listen, we're playing our starters in this preseason, at least the first preseason game, for maybe a series or two. So do you think the Titans, knowing their situation at offensive line, should they also, you think they should be thinking that way in regards to the offensive line? I'm not talking about Henry, Ryan Tannehill, right. D-Hop. I'm just saying the offensive line specifically.
Yes. I mean, Aaron Brewer needs to be able to call some protections at the line the way Ben Jones would, name the assignments. I mean, every center is going to know pretty much every spot on the offensive line for that reason. But again, like they're getting reps during the practices. But I mean, with Hubbard and Brewer, Brunskill, Skoronski, Dillard at left tackle, I'm playing these guys. I know the scare factor of injuries, and we certainly know what can happen if one guy goes down. That can happen on a day-to-day basis, though. I would be taking advantage of live reps just at minimum to make sure that guys are on the same page with conversation, cohesion, and communication. And that's to their benefit right now, that they could have the leisure of not having to worry about the last few years because the veterans were back. And before they dropped out due to injury, the veterans were back, and you knew that they at least knew what to do and knew the offense inside and out. Some of these guys have been around for a bit. Some haven't. And some they're betting on to be better than where they were. And, I mean, they need to go into week one better than they have the last couple of years. And Caroline, back to your question about excitement to see. I mean, Malik Willis, by all accounts, has been really, really improved compared to what we saw last year, which was awful. How does that translate over into game action? And then Will Levis, lauded by every draft analyst and many fans that would have him in the top 15, top 10, top 5. It's time for him to show up a bit, you know, or lead an offense and do it with receivers that they've also relied on in the past through draft picks, like Kyle Phillips, Racy McMath, that those guys play, plus Colton Dow. Let's see if he can shine a bit. Mason Kinsey always shines in the preseason. I want to see if Colton Dow can make a name there.
Now, you mentioned a few guys here that needs to shine, Hutt. Is Sasan Haskins one of those guys? Because even though he's a tremendous special teams player, we had TD on the other day, and we were talking about the running back situation. Hasan, Tajay Spears, who they drafted in the third round, Jonathan Ward, and some Chestnut. These guys are really coming on. Even though Tajay is struggling a bit, and he even said it, like, there's some things I'm struggling with, but they see the playmaking ability in him. To me, Hasan Haskins, from a running back standpoint, is sort of like he's been the guy that's sort of been left out of this. We know what he can do from a special teams standpoint, but what can he give them from a running back standpoint?
Yeah, and I mean, the Haskins is, to me, the two-down guy a lot like Henry. Spears is described to me as a true three-down back. He's different than Haskins. Haskins has to be the role guy. He's got to do the grunt work. And that would go without saying for Chestnut and Ward as well. But the grunt work would include special teams. And Haskins was very good in that area. Ward was briefly on this practice squad last year, I believe, at the end of the season. And you've got Chestnut, who has made a name for himself on special teams as well in preseasons of past. So, yeah, this is a battle, but this is always going to be where Haskins is on a roster, Mace. I mean, this is the typical life of a pro football player. You know, you bounce around a bit. It's not often that you get drafted by a team at that spot as a special teamer and a backup running back, and you stick with them for a while. You're in this every year. You never feel comfortable. And the best guys that handle it from the stress factor end up making the roster because, you know, they're cool, calm, and collected whenever it's time to shine. and you make a name for yourself towards the end of the preseason, when it's down to a last couple roster spots, and you show out in the joint practice work and in the final preseason game. And they have that 2 weeks off before the regular season. They're cutting everyone down at one last time. I mean, to me, this is a roster spot that goes down to the final game and then the final few practices before the final cutdown, simply because they want to keep the stress factor up as much as possible and see who shines. And they could keep two guys, by the way. Mm-hmm. If they need an extra spot for special teams, if they think that there's a better version of a special teams guy at running back instead of safety as their sixth safety or a backer, for instance, I'm intrigued how they maneuver that spot and how much that could affect other positions like wide receiver or tight end.
Jonathan Hutton is with us. Hutton, coming up next, we've got a funeral to plan, not just for
the
Pac-12, but for college football as a whole, as we know it. I want to get your thoughts on the changes going around in college football and the changes that are soon to come.
Is this a funeral or a celebration of life?
Both. Okay. We will mourn Pac-12 after dark while celebrating how fun it was when we had it. And we'll get to that with Hutton coming up next. Caroline, Willie, D-Mace, 102.5, 106.3, The Game.
Having some fun in the midday.
Okay, that's really fun.
This is Caroline, Willie, and D-Mace.
It's a good source of energy because it's live.
On 102.5 and 106.3, The Game and the Game Nashville app.
Caroline, Willie, D-Mace, 102.5, 106.3, The Game and the Game Nashville app. Jonathan Hutton, Hot Mike with Hutton and Withrow is with us now. Hutton, in the matter of a week, college football, as we know it, has completely changed. Because, of course, Texas and Oklahoma going to the SEC was a massive change. Of course, USC and UCLA going to the Big Ten, a massive change. But once Washington and Oregon decided to jump ship from the Pac-12 and head to the Big Ten, that essentially killed the Pac-12. Do you think that these are all, with conference realignment, are they good changes? Are they bad changes? Or are they simply just changes as far as college football is concerned?
Well, it's not good. It's not bad. It's just inevitable. And it's reality because of the money involved in live programming at the highest level for football. The NFL is king in this country. And right behind it is the SEC and the Big Ten, the highest level of college football. And then that creates the haves and the have-nots, and everyone wants a piece of the pie. And the networks, they all get fat and happy off of NFL numbers because everybody has a piece of the NFL pie, and everyone's ratings are massive compared to what else they're airing. So that's the battle of what the other conferences are now going against. It's, okay, how do we include ourselves and continue to be where we were and be attached to whatever is about to become the new reality of college athletics, college football in particular here, but it can branch forward with other sports. That's what everyone's faced with. And that then creates what we saw in the Pac-12, where unlike, what you would see with the ACC because of their grant of rights and then also their media deal with ESPN, Pac-12 didn't have anyone looking out for them, that no one had their back. No one was trying to or had a reason to keep them aboard instead of bringing on who they wanted to bring on and picking out the pieces that they wanted and casting everyone else aside because there was no penalty to add them. That caused the demise of the Pac-12. And it's what we have seen from your mark. He's done excellent work with the Big 12 because we were saying the same things about them when Texas and Oklahoma first announced. And what they've done compared to what the Pac-12 did when USC and UCLA announced this last year that they were going to the Big Ten has been vastly different. One's alive and we're holding a funeral for the other one.
You're absolutely right about that, Hutt. But
a celebration of life.
Let's call it a celebration of life, because that's what it is, a new life for college football. But I'm just trying to – two things for you, Hutt. One, why do you think people are such in an uproar? Because they had to have seen this coming, that this alignment was going to basically boil down to, two or three conferences and ultimately, maybe just three power conferences. One, why are people such an uproar? And then two, do you think there was much talk in regards to other sports within these universities, or the talk was just football and possibly even men's basketball?
Yeah, men's basketball may have come up for the Big 12 with mm-hmm. some of the programs they've added. But this is about football because unlike the other sports that could be mentioned, football is the revenue king. Football is funding the other sports, and the conferences and their media rights contracts are paid for that sport and that programming. Basketball, too, from the ACC's perspective and what ESPN wants during, you know, the winter and spring going into the tournament. But Mace, I mean, they're speaking out now, but the ones that are in an uproar are either saying it way too late on purpose to act like they're high and mighty, or they're in an uproar because they're not a part of the group. And this is, you know, the branching off of where the money's going, where the contracts are going, where the players are going, and ultimately where the eyeballs are going to be. You know, the Pac-12's the online streaming option that they had was the only option, so it was a good option for them to even consider. It's the only one on the table, but it was bad because their biggest brands had to be behind a paywall. It was subscription based. You want to drive up subs, you couldn't put them on free TV, and it needed to be flip-flopped. It needed to be the other way around, and the Pac-12 didn't have that option. They went under eyeballs, and that's what the bickering is about more than anything. And it's also, you know, the other side of it, too, is the money that's being made, while at the same time, the same commissioners, the ADs, some coaches, they just watched the literal transfer portal of an entire conference while complaining about it weeks earlier of an open portal for college football players. It's very hypocritical. And to me, that's the biggest headline. They're going to Capitol Hill asking for federal legislation, saying everything's out of hand from the players' end of things. And weeks later, they did this through multiple leaders. And it's not like behind the scenes guys didn't know what was going to happen. This has been on the table for some time, and it happened now because the media rights contract was up for the Pac-12 and they had nowhere to go.
Jonathan Hutton is with us. Hutton, where do you think the college football playoff goes from here? Because when we expand to a 12-team playoff in 2024, six teams, as currently constructed, get an automatic bid, accommodating for the five Power Five conferences, RIP to the Power Five, and then kind of opening the door for a group of five, an AAC, a Tulane, a Cincinnati, so on and so forth. Do they stick with six? How do they accommodate for the changing landscape of the Power Five?
Well, so the six was a compromise because Greg Sankey and Kevin Warren at the time wanted more at-large bids. And keep in mind, Sankey was pushing for a 16-team college football playoff.
Interesting that comes from those two.
Right, yeah. And there were, you know, everyone was saying, you know, whispering, you know, we don't trust those guys. When I say everyone, the other conferences, other coaches, other programs, ADs, no one trusted ESPN and the money that was going to be handed out with what the SEC was about to get. And this was on the other side of the Big Ten just signing their new media rights deal and the package they put together, which is very much like the NFL model with three main networks promoting them and programming them each and every weekend. So the trust factor, there was a compromise from the most powerful people in college sports, Sankey and Warren at the time, which is now Petitti. They said, okay, we'll do a 12-team and we'll have automatic qualifiers so everybody can get a piece, and then we'll have, you know, the true other best teams included in this. Well, I think what happens now, because we have a Power Four instead of a Power Five, you either reduce the automatic qualifiers or you find a way to keep the automatic qualifiers where they are, and then you add more teams to the college football playoff. If you want to be in the playoff now as an automatic qualifier and you're not a Power Four, if you're not the Big 12, ACC, Big 10, or SEC, you're going to have to make a compromise now because everyone else is abandoning ship, and this plane will take off without you unless you want to bend the knee to the highest powers. And it's not the NCAA, it's the SEC and Big 10.
Now, Hutt, quickly, I don't know if you've started to watch or seen the docuseries on Johnny Manziel, Untold Johnny Football.
Yeah, I saw it.
And so good. Yeah, it's so good. And I'm sure you believe it to be the same. Tell me, what were your thoughts then as compared to now? Because I told Caroline, I said, while we were in it and watching it, I didn't realize how big it truly was. You know, we just saw this kid doing some crazy stuff, playing really well on the field, but we never really thought how big his story was and how much his play meant to the Dollars at Texas A&M.
I mean, he was a caricature. You know, he was a brand. We never really saw Johnny Manziel. We saw Johnny mm-hmm. Football, mm-hmm. you know? And the face of the franchise for the Browns was Johnny Football, not Manziel. So he could get away with that at A&M and not just get away with it. He reigned. I mean, he won a Heisman Trophy without looking at a bit of tape. If he didn't do it with the Cleveland Browns, he certainly wasn't doing it at A&M. And he's beating Saban. He's winning a Heisman. And he's taking college football by storm. Vern Lundquist is the soundtrack of his entire career. I mean, it's incredible. And, you know, he's opening up a bar now in College Station. So, I mean, I think his bar is called Money, the Money Bar.
Fitting.
I mean, again, like it was incredible. And in the moment, I think you realize you're watching something. It's like magic, mm-hmm. right? He comes in as a freshman and what he does and then how his just entire persona took off. But behind the scenes, I mean, there's something to be said for having to be on all the time. You know, there's only a few people that can pull that off day to day to day. And in Manziel's case, night after night after night. And eventually that catches up with you. And then when you have that much success and then you completely bottom out when you're at the next level with all the expectation, things come cratering in on you. Chad and I spoke to the director of the Untold Johnny Football documentary yesterday on Hot Mic. And I asked him, I was like, did you know going into making this film that he was going to open up about his suicidal thoughts and how he had already planned out to give himself a reason to kill himself? And he said that happened in the moment. Everyone was in the room, all the production crew. Normally, if it's a very emotional or deep topic, they'll clear everyone out and it's just one-on-one if he knew in advance. And he said Manziel opened up to him in that moment. And then when they were finished filming that portion of the segment, he went outside next to the pool, smoked a cigarette. And that's when the director came out and asked him about it, you know, like, so it was, that was real. And I'm glad that he told his story the way he did, because I think it lets you in on the emotional aspect of the person that's talking to him. And it was himself instead of listening to anyone else. And so many people had success off of him that, I mean, it's like Herman with the Yankees. If he's throwing a perfect game in June and now he's in alcohol rehab, and you know, it's gotta be a mental process. I can't imagine what it's like, but there's gotta be a mental state where you're doing all this, but you're still at the highest level of your craft, of your work, of your game. And you think, well, it's not affecting this, so let's keep it going. And I think it all came crashing down.
Yeah, I think it was a reminder to me that so much of what we see for celebrities, let's say celebrities, because that's what Johnny Manziel was in 2012, 2013.
Oh, yeah.
He was a celebrity.
Still is.
Yeah.
Still is. He's still Johnny F. Football. That there's only so much of the story that we see. There's only one layer that we see. It's going on behind closed doors that we, at least for Johnny Football's sake, haven't seen until now.
Well, and Chad and I, this is a name drop, but when we were at the Outkick the Tailgate, we were at the A&M Bama game, A&M won with Calzada. And we went out afterwards with Billy Lucci and with Manziel. And Johnny Football, I mean, when you say he's a celebrity, I mean, he is the king of the College Station bubble.
Legend,
as Chad is yelling out in the studio with me.
Hey, Chad.
He's hashtag legend, and the doors open, and people, there are volunteers who will jump off balconies in order to allow the bar to stay at the max capacity and not have the fire marshal called with Johnny Manziel's group that enters the bar. It's incredible.
Just absolutely insane. And, you know, if you are a celebrity almost, like, you know, nationwide, you're going to be a celebrity in College Station, Texas on just a different level. Hutton, appreciate you for joining us. We'll chat with you next week.
I always love this, guys. Have a great rest of the week. And, yeah, look forward to it. Enjoy the preseason.
Awesome. Thanks, Absolutely. Hutton. Appreciate you. Coming up next, let's get into our thoughts on the documentary. Because I had one of the biggest takeaways from the documentary, and I'll share that coming up next. Caroline, Willie, D-Mace, 102.5, 106.3 The Game.